Blog Talk Radio.
Fathers, mothers, sisters, brothers, cousins, friends, sons and daughters, uncles, aunts, and grandparents, I'm so glad you're my family. Oh, I'm so glad.
Welcome to the Families Matters show at BTR's World of Ink Network with your hosts, V.S. Grenier, and myself, Irene Rose. Keisha Bertram is usually with us tonight, but sadly she won't be able to join us. She'll certainly be on our future shows. It's truly an honor to be here with you today. It's Monday, June the 27th, 2012, at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. If you'd like to call in and join our wonderful discussion tonight, the phone number to call is 714-242-5259. That's 714-242-5259.
Thanks, Irene. That was a wonderful opening. Yes, we're sad to say that Keisha isn't with us today. She lost a member of her family, her father, so she is off with her family, consoling with everybody. So we just want her to know that our thoughts are with her and her family, as always. Mm-hmm. Yes, yeah, so not a happy note, unfortunately, to not have Keisha with us, but we hope she travels safely. She goes to meet up with her family and that they all know that they're in our prayers. And on a happy note, to bring the mood back up, I have to share. you know me. I just found out, gosh, I think it was the end of last week, that my picture book, Babysitting Sugar Paw, which has been out for a couple of years now, was given the Silver 2012 Mom's Choice Award. So
that
I was very
great.
Excited to get that email. I know I was like dancing around. Of course, now I have to get back to my writing that I put on hold temporarily. I'm like, well, now that I won an award, I guess I can't do that. I need to carve out that writing.
You have to celebrate.
Yes, I did. Everybody sees me like, I hope you went and had, you know, better bubbles later because I took my kids to the park and we had a picnic and of course, we took bubbles, and they blew bubbles at the park.
Oh, that's
like,
great.
Yeah, everybody's like, I hope you had the sparkling bubbles later.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
So, but it was fun. They were excited, you know, that I won the award. And if anybody doesn't know what the Mom's Choice Award is that's listening, it's basically a seal of approval from moms. It's a group of moms who review not just books, they review products, websites, magazines, not just kids' books, you know, books oriented to families, inspirational, motivational books as well. I mean, they look at a lot of different things. So it's really exciting to have their seal of approval on my book and say, yes, we like it. We think it's, you know, a really great product, service, or a book for families out there. So I'm excited.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. What an honor.
And Irene has a book that's going to be coming out soon, too, so we're excited about that. And we'll be next month in July. Usually we take our July month off. Keisha won't be with us in July either because that's when we usually take vacation time from the show. But Irene and I will be on the show because we're going to share about her book and what it's about. So you'll have to definitely tune in next month and learn about her upcoming book because we're excited about Irene's book, too. So.
We all write, don't we?
Yes, we all do. Which brings us right to our special guest tonight. Usually we don't have special guests on our show, and lately we have been, which has actually been fun and different and exciting here on the Family Matters show. We have author Deb Boris with us, and what's exciting about having her on our show is not only is she an author and has written a book called Painted Black, which just recently released, The research and the idea of her book, it's a suspense novel. It's not a kid's book. It's for older readers. It's a suspense novel that has that twists reality of Chicago's homeless community, which is exactly why we're having her on the show, because she has worked in homeless shelters, which gave her a great, you know, place to cultivate research information to write on this particular subject, or have it actually in her book. And so we asked her to join us today so we could kind of talk about, unfortunately, with the awful economy that's going on, not just here in the U.S., but around the world, that there's a lot of families and kids that are living on the streets because they're losing their homes left and right, or unfortunately victims of circumstance and just don't have a home. And I actually have a friend who adopted a son from... I'm going to get it wrong. I can't remember which country over it is, over in Africa. But anyway, she has a son she adopted, and he literally was 3 years old living on the street. So this is a serious problem globally. So, Deb, we're glad to have you on the show today and to talk about your book and just to talk about this ever-growing awful problem in our world.
Thank you for having me. I'm looking forward to the discussion.
Yeah. Can you share a little bit more with our listeners, your background, and then, of course, you know, what inspired your book, Painted Black, so they get a really good idea of who you are? And I know you've been on Blog Talk over the last, you know, few days quite a bit, but we might have somebody who hasn't heard those shows.
Sure. The idea for Painted Black, originally when I first thought of it, was mainly going with the idea of a suspense mystery. Didn't necessarily have anything to do with homelessness in it, although I was thinking that I wanted to concentrate on issues that affect children, to sort of highlight that. But then when I moved to Chicago, I had done so with the express desire to get involved with working with a couple of homeless organizations that I had heard of that work with homeless youth. So not so much the families, although there are a lot of homeless families out there, but kids without parents who have either been kicked out or had to run away or were for some other reason homeless. And my interest in that generated the idea that I wanted my books to focus around telling the story of one individual homeless person in such a way that someone who is interested in just the mystery suspense of the story might, without even realizing that, get a good idea of what it's like for these kids that don't have anyone to advocate for them on the streets. And they will enjoy the story, but yet know some reality at the same time. So that's kind of what prompted my idea.
Sorry, I'm opening our chat room. So our listeners know, I am opening the chat room. I'm sorry, I just realized we didn't have it open. This is what I get of multitasking today. We're getting one person and
a lot of multitasking.
I'm doing it all. No, I think that's great. When you'd contacted us about your book and, you know, this topic and being on one of our shows here at the World of Ink Network, and we decided the Family Matters show is definitely one of the best places to put you, just because we deal with, you know, issues and talk about all kinds of stuff on the show that, you know, is related to these kinds of things. Keisha and I were kind of talking because Keisha's a counselor out in Nashville. And so, you know, she deals with a lot of kids and family problems that, you know, that go on through her counseling. And her and I were both talking about how we've noticed with school districts that a lot of them have started up, you know, I don't want to say, you know, kids don't go hungry type programs, but basically that's what they are, you know, to help kids that don't have, you know, parents that don't have a lot of money, that can't feed their kids, or even kids that they're not sure are living on the streets or not, you know, because their parents are using, you know, some type of PO box or something like that for their mail. And I was really shocked that our school here, because it's summertime, you think, okay, well, you know, when school's over, you know, the schools wouldn't continue doing the meals for the kids, and they actually continued into the summer, where children in my area out here in the Washington County School District in Southern Utah can still go in the morning and get breakfast for free. And I thought that was
just excellent. Amazing.
To see happen, because you know, I don't think a lot of people realize how important those things are. I've never lived on the street, and I don't want anybody to think that, but I have lived in low-income housing when I was a kid. When my parents divorced, my mom, she was a bank teller. She just, there was no way she was making, you know, enough money to support just her and myself. And my dad was not paying alimony, wasn't paying child support. So we were solely on our own. And I remember going to the food bank with my mom to get food because we just did not have money to where we could pay rent and she could put gas in the car. Thank goodness her car was at least paid off, so she didn't have a car payment. But just to cover utilities and just, you know, putting clothing on our back, I mean, we could get some groceries, but not enough, you know, for a week or for 2 weeks. So we had to get supplemented food, you know, through a food bank. And, you know, they're not easy to find, but they're out there. And I think people think that the problem isn't as a big of a problem because it's not visually in your face, but it is there. So I think it's great, even though your book is a fiction book, you know, it does, because, you know, you working and being involved with these organizations, you know, there's a lot of stuff in there that, you know, makes people realize, oh, you know, obviously, you know, she didn't make all this up, and this has to be some real stuff that's out there, and I think that's just phenomenal. With your experience working in shelters and stuff, is there anything that you've noticed that people aren't aware, you know, just everyday people aren't aware enough about when it comes to homeless, you know, people and families and children on the streets that we need to be more aware about?
Well, I think there's probably a whole bunch of things. One of the things that strike me as most unfair is the fact that people tend to look at homeless kids and adults, for that matter, as being something to be feared or to be stayed away from. But what I've discovered is that if you treat a kid with respect, he is more likely than some of the teens that live in suburbanite with their moms and dads, he's more likely to be respectful back to you because they so very seldom have someone treat them like a human being, just smiling and saying hi, for instance, that they will give you the respect that you're looking for if you simply treat them with respect also. So I think that's something no one realizes. They just figure that there's something wrong about the person, either they're an addict or they're mentally ill, and so therefore they don't want anything to do with them. They don't bother to get to know them. And I know kids that I would trust with my life before I would trust some people that I know.
Yeah. No, and I hear you on that. I used to work on Hollywood Boulevard and for a company, not on the streets. clarify that. No, I mean, you can say that. I'd be like, well, really, she worked on Hollywood Boulevard. No, I worked for, and I hardly ever say what companies I work for, but I will say this company because I loved working there. I worked for Fredericks of Hollywood. I was actually a buyer for Fredericks of Hollywood. And Fredericks of Hollywood, the store, the mat, and the little mail catalog of lingerie. That's who I worked for. I worked for them for many years. And they have a store right there on Hollywood Boulevard, right, I kid you not, right there. Jamie Lee Curtis, I was there when she got her star right in front of the store. But a lot of people don't realize that when you walk in the store, there's actually this little side door when you're looking at the store that's to the left. They're moved now, but when I was there, you'd go through that door and it actually took you into the corporate offices. So I, for many years, would see, because there's a lot of cubby holes, and we had an alleyway between us and actually the Rainbow Coalition for the gay rights movement there in Hollywood. And so we had a lot of homeless people who lived in that alleyway. Every day I saw them, you know, tucked up in the corners. I couldn't go out and walk the strip, you know, to get lunch, to go get coffee, to go meet my vendors, whatever I needed to do, without seeing them. I mean, you'd walk past Pantages or the Chinese, you know, Pantages Theater and Chinese Man, and there's these little cubbies, and they're tucked up, and they're dirty, and they're filthy, and people just, you know, I'm not just talking about people who work, you know, and on the with the company, you know, with all the different businesses that are there. I mean, even the tourists, you know, they just walk by and just complete blinders to these people. And one of the biggest things that we did as buyers is we would really try and reach out to them, because since we're out and we always wanted to see what was going on, you know, always involved with what was going on, especially with Fredericks, because that was like their big thing. They always were very big with what was going on with the celebs and stuff. So we were at a lot of different functions. We kind of paid attention, of course, to people that were watching him, you know, because, you know, trying to figure out our market. And we started noticing that a lot of the homeless people, at least on the strip, there was this one homeless guy. He had to – I never talked to him because he just – if you try to say hi to him or something, he just wouldn't look at you. He'd always look down. But he was an amputee. He was missing – I can't remember if it was his left or his right leg, but he was missing one of his legs. And, you know, full beard, you know, type guy. And he always had a rag and Windex. And I don't think anybody paid him from in the city of Hollywood, but he would Windex the stars on the strip and clean them every day. He'd work up one side and down the other side of the street every day cleaning them. And so finally the buyers and I, because we, you know, we're noticing these small little things that a lot of the homeless, you know, people in that community were doing. Anytime we saw them doing stuff like that, we would get pay them money and tell them thank you for, you know, keeping the strip nice. And so you're right. I think that people don't realize that, you know, these are real people with real feelings. And, you know, sometimes whatever the circumstances, just no one's giving them the break they need. And I remember it really made that guy's day when we would just, you know, put the money down in front of him and just say, have a good day and keep going.
Yeah. Well, even if you don't feel comfortable giving them money, I know a lot of people are worried about what are they going to use the money for kind of thing. Even if you don't feel comfortable giving them money, I think there's nothing wrong with saying, hey, I'm going to go into the drugstore over here. Can I pick you up a candy bar or a soda or a bag of chips? Or even if you don't want to do that, you don't realize how much of a difference it makes in a person's day if you just smile and say hi, or if they ask you for money, instead of, you know, totally avoiding them or giving them a dirty look even, just say, I'm sorry, I can't today. And if you respond with respect 9 times out of 10, not all the time, but then regular people aren't all the time always polite either, they're going to be polite back to you, and they're going to understand.
Yeah,
I found that so much because, of course, I worked and lived in Toronto for about 12 years, about 15 years ago, I guess now. And I certainly was working downtown, and I was passing by a lot of homeless people at that time, too. And I always took the time out of the day just to say hi and how are you. And sometimes they'd even want to talk, you know. It was just one of these things where some of these people are very lonely. And, you know, they want to just connect with another person. And, you know, when you give them the time, a lot of times they don't even need the money necessarily. Of course, they do need the money. But, you know, they accept the fact that you're actually, you know, acknowledging that, you know, you're another human being and they're another human being and you're wanting to really talk to them and connect with them. And I found that that really made their day, too. A lot of times they would tell me that, you know, thank you for talking to me because no one else does, you know. So
exactly.
That was really something, you know. So I always, you know, passed them with respect and also always smiled, always said hi. And, you know, and I found that that really helped them and that made me feel good, too. So it's a two-way street, kind of, you know.
Right. Another thing that I used to do when I lived in Chicago and was a little more involved than I am right now, there were a bunch of different organizations in the city that had services. So what I did was I had some of the contact information on some of those places where they could either get food or get shelter printed up on little pieces of paper. And if I saw someone, I would say, do you have somewhere to sleep tonight, or are you looking for some help finding housing or something to eat tonight? If they didn't already have a place, I was able to give them a card that would give them information for places that they could go. Because quite frankly, there really aren't that many places that offer services, particularly if you're talking about the kids, the youth.
Yeah.
They don't like to go to the adult shelters because that's where they get preyed upon. And it's a little bit scary for them to be around all those older people who are so sometimes entrenched in homelessness that they're really scary to them.
Right.
And there aren't really that many shelters or beds available just for youth.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
Yeah. And that's a very, you know, valid thing to bring up because it's true. I want to say, being really close to Skid Row, and if anybody doesn't know what Skid Row, it's about I want to say about two blocks worth of, during the day you don't notice it because you see regular shops. This is in the heart of downtown L.A. It was really close to the Fashion District, so I know where this place is really well. And if anybody knows where the Bonaventure is, the hotel, which is really close to the Los Angeles airport, it's literally about a block and a half from there. Is where Skid Row is in downtown L.A. And during the day, it's regular shops. You know, you see a lot of people just doing their regular everyday, you know, type little mom and pop type shops along the street. But about, I want to say about 8 o'clock at night, when you know, when those guys are leaving, the shop owners are leaving, all of a sudden you just see blankets and cardboard boxes and like makeshift type, you know, tents with old clothing, whatever, rags, come up. And that's the almost a huge population of a homeless community. And you're right, most of the people who are in there are usually, you know, I want to say over 30 years old or older. You don't really see a lot of kids because they are afraid to even congregate in those environments, even on the streets, because, you know, they are easier prey because they're not as streetwise as people who've been on the street longer. And it's sad because, you know, they need help, but they don't know where to get it. And, you know, and then those of us who can, you know, maybe help them find help, you know, we're looking, I'm going, oh, little punk, you know, kind of thing. And it's just, it's true though. It's so unfair.
Right.
You know,
and what happens to those poor kids? You know, some of them just really fall through the cracks, don't they? I mean, oh boy.
Yeah. I think I read somewhere, that, in Chicago, for instance, I believe there's only something like 120 beds that are in youth-specific shelters that are available to them, and yet the statistics are like in a year there's probably around $10,000 youth that are counted as being homeless. There's just not nearly enough beds, for instance, for the number of kids that are out there.
Wow, that's a huge number. Wow.
Yeah.
That is a huge number.
My
goodness. No, I don't know this, and I've never talked to any of our places here in the southern Utah area, but, I mean, I do know that there's at crisis youth centers. In your experience, do you know if any of those guys help, you know, open up their, you know, doors to usually, I mean, mostly because I know they end up at those, you know, crisis youth centers. Usually their parents put them there or the police put them there because they're at risk of going criminal. But for homeless kids, I mean, is that a place maybe they can turn to, like, help get them back on their feet and out, or would you say probably not?
Well, I think it depends on the city. There, different cities have different opportunities, and I'm sure that there's more that I'm not even aware of. But I do know, for instance, here in Seattle where I live now, there is a organization that has several churches that work with them that open their doors in the evening for kids to sleep.
Great.
They're like throw mattresses down. But even then, boy, I've been in those places where we've like served food before the kids get there. They're not really that big. So you're probably talking at most 25 kids. It's sort of like first come, first serve.
Right.
And you'll have a whole bunch there for eating, but then not all that many can stay for sleeping. And I don't, that I know of, know any other organization in Seattle that has any place for them to sleep. Emergency care shelters usually just come out when the weather is really extreme here. So I'm not that familiar with what you're talking about, the emergency care services. There are quite a few organizations in Chicago that offer services to youth, but not that many of them actually have beds that are available. And those are usually considered more transitional housing situations. So it's not the ones I know of. It's not a shelter where you just go for the night and then you have to leave in the morning, which is actually a good thing, that you want something more than that. They're there for the kids to come in and get involved with a case manager. They take a look at the kids' history, where they're trying to go, what skills they need to get there, and the case manager helps develop a plan to either get a job or go to school so that they can maybe move on to the next step, go into perhaps a group housing. There are some transitional housing type of facilities where they will help kids that can live there for a year until they're able to make, because housing is so expensive that you can't make money even if you do have a full-time job.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. And, like, everything has skyrocketed in terms of price, hasn't it? So.
Yeah. It doesn't. The amount of money that we pay, the minimum wage, just does not match the minimum amount of rent that is needed to survive in most of these cities.
Well, that's great, because I think a lot of these kids, you know, once they get the help and once they get on their feet, most of them are successful, aren't they not, in terms of making a living for themselves?
Yeah, I don't really have statistics to particular to support that. I certainly hope so. I know, though, that I have met older men that I've talked with when I worked for the night ministry, that some of those were homeless when they were young as well. It depends. What happens is when they get out on the street, if they don't have someone to provide support for them, that's when they end up getting into things like alcohol or drug abuse or even prostitution. And that's a downward spiral. Once they start down that road, it's very, very difficult for them to climb their way out of it. So if there isn't any hand that's held out to them, the odds are that they might not make it. They really need somebody there, or it's just not going to work.
Yeah, but it almost becomes a habit for them to be homeless, right? So
it sort of does. And your self-esteem gets low.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, kids' self-esteems are difficult, especially teens, are difficult even in the best of circumstances.
Mm-hmm.
But if you've been in an abusive home and you're now out on the street where people are treating you like dirt, nobody wants to help you out, you're going to think you are worthless, and therefore you're going to begin to act like you're worthless. And it's just hard to convince them otherwise sometimes.
It's a terrible cycle. Yeah,
it is. And the one thing I can talk about here in southern Utah is being where I live, we have, you know, a lot of the polygamy sects out here from the fundamentalist LDS church. And I know people have heard about it. I know up in Canada, I don't know exactly by you, Irene, if you guys have too many. I do know there's plugs up there in Canada. I just don't know if you're near any of them.
Mm-hmm.
But I do know the big problem, and I don't know if anybody's ever watched, like, the Seventh White, 13th White, whatever it was on TV. And then there's been a few that have been done about the women who, out here in my area, have written books, memoirs about Warren Jeffs and all of that nastiness with that group that, I kid you not, they're not that far away from where I live. Colorado City and Hilldale are very, very close to me. They're probably about, I don't know, 2-hour drive from my house at max. Anyways, they do, honestly, they're called the Lost Boys, and they really do kick out the young men. Not all of them, but I'd say probably the 65 to 70 something percent of them do get kicked out when they're young, and they really drive them out here to the Washington County borderline city of St. George, you know, city limits, and drop them off out in the middle of the desert and tell them to walk. And it's really, really sad. Now, my husband, being that he works with the emergency responders and in dispatch, you know, he hears the stories, you know, that come out of there. And it's just, it's sad. And the one thing they've done for at least those boys, the Lost Boys is what they're called, there's been a lot of people who have either left the polygamy communities, or people who just really, you know, understand how awful this is. I mean, because they anywhere from ages 8 to teenage, you know, and they're teenagers, 16 years old, they just throw them out, and they have nowhere to go. You know, they get completely ostracized from their families. And so there's been a couple of groups that start up. I don't know their names, but there are people who actually open up their homes and, you know, basically become like foster parents to these kids. And try and help them, but a lot of them do. They fall into, because especially for that community, because they're so locked away from the modern world, it's like culture shock for those poor boys, and a lot of them end up falling into drugs and into criminal activity because they just, you know, everything they know is now gone, literally.
Yeah, they're
family,
just trying to survive. How can they survive?
It is the saddest thing to see happen, you know, and... It, I mean, I thought it was bad when I worked, like I said, out in Hollywood in L.A. and seeing the homeless. But, you know, families actually throwing their kids onto the street like that, just it just baffles me. I'm just like, wow, how can you call it? You know, this isn't the Mormon church. These are, like, a completely different group of people that that are doing it. And it's just like, wow, holy cow. Yeah, it's sad, and that was like, you know, when you contacted me, that's one of the biggest things that went through my head. You know, I was thinking about when I used to live out in California, and then, you know, what I'm seeing happening to these poor boys now out here in southern Utah, and it actually happens up in northern Utah because they have plague communities up there as well. And, you know, I was like, wow, homelessness, you know, this is literally a big problem in Utah, huge problem in Utah.
Wow.
Because of this, you know, like I said, the fundamentalist sect that does this, and it's sad.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so I guess my question to you would be, you know, I'm going to play devil's advocate here. A lot of people, and I've heard this, and I'll totally be honest, you know, it crossed my mind sometimes, and then, of course, I started digging into it one time, because I was like, someone's just making this up. You know, you'll see somebody... You'll be driving along, or you'll be walking in to go do your grocery shopping. You see somebody holding up, you know, the cardboard cutout that says, you know, we'll work for food, or, you know, homeless need food, whatever. You know, they're little different signs that they have. And somebody said, you know what, they can't do that unless they have a business license. And these people actually are making a living out of basically the kind hearts of people. And trying to say they're poor and they dress all grungy and stuff, but they're not. And so I dug into that one time to see, you know, how true that story is. And I found out, I don't know about here in Utah. I've never dug here in Utah, but unfortunately in Southern California, that was very true. There's a lot of people in the San Diego County, I can verify this, that actually are, their business is peddling. And they have a business license to peddle. And I was like, wow, okay, so how... So, and I'm not saying everybody on the streets like this, everybody, because I'm not saying that. I mean, but unfortunately, there are some people who are now using this to, of course, get rich. And so I guess my question to you, Deb, is, I mean, have you heard of this? And have you found that, unfortunately, that has maybe tainted people more against helping, you know, the actual homeless community? Because now we're sort of going, you know, are they just, you know, a business peddler, or are they really someone who needs my help?
Well, I have to say I've never run into anybody that was panhandling, that actually was making a living wage out of it. So I don't know what kind of incomes you found out those people were making from panhandling, but I find it hard to believe that they could possibly be making enough money to have a decent life out of, that it would make it worth their while. And if there are some people that are making enough money for it to be worth the amount of money or time that you have to spend out there, I think that's a very rare and unusual situation, and really so unlikely that I don't think you should assume that people who are doing this might be doing that. I find it hard to believe, not that it didn't, that it happened, because I'm sure it does, but it shouldn't cloud your thinking when you're looking at someone. I mean, think about it. How much do you have to make an hour waiting tables in order to be able to spend $1,000 a month on an apartment and then buy food and then pay your utilities? How much panhandling do you think it would take to make $2,000 a month, which in some states and some cities is the minimum amount you would have to make in order to have a halfway decent life? I'm thinking that if somebody is panhandling and they're making enough money to live up to my standards, which isn't really that high, to tell you the truth, I'd say more power to them, because I don't see it happening very often, and it just seems, it just blows my mind that it would even be possible.
Yeah, well, there's this one guy, and it was in San Diego, and it was back when I was in college, and I had heard about it. I was like, really? Because I was kind of shocked by that. And so it never really tainted my – because I know the majority of people who are on the streets. I mean, the majority of them are there because they've been kicked out of mental institutions, ran away from home when they were younger, foreclosed on for their house, you know, return, you know, military, you know, all various reasons to be out on the street. But, yeah, this one guy, I want to say, he was making, I don't know, like $30,000, $40,000 a year just panhandling every day out in San Diego. And people found out about it because they're like, you know, some reporter did an article, and I mean, they really dug into it, and they found this guy had a license to actually panhandle, and which was kind of like, really, you're peddling on the streets, and you're making an income. I'm like, shame. And what really went through my mind was like, shame on you, because people are going to hear this story. And I remember thinking this when I was in my 20s, going, people are going to hear this story, and now they're going to look at every single person on the street and go, all right, do you have a business license to be doing this? You probably do, so I'm not going to give you any money, because now they're like worried that, you know, you're trying to. And to me, that's how I felt. I mean, I was actually very disgusted that somebody turned that into a career when there's honest people out there who are, you know, suffering, and somebody's making it their career to look like they're doing that. I was just like, wow.
Well, I'm just going to play devil's advocate here, and I don't really know how much the cost of living is in San Diego, but what kind of life can you live for $30,000 a year? Can someone live a good life for $30,000 in San Diego area? That sounds like barely minimum wage to me. So I don't know why it would be that good of a living.
Yeah. Right? Well, it was back in the 90s, so obviously the economy was a little different.
Okay.
So you'd be okay. I'm aging myself now.
We're all aging.
Many years ago. A decade ago. Decades ago. Anyways, but yeah. Early 90s, too.
We're 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, now everybody's like, wow, she's old. Yeah, like I said, it was a long time ago. But, you know, it really shocked me. I thought, I was like, wow, you know, and I was like, there can't be that many people, because it was the same thing that went through my mind, Deb, was there can't be this many people doing this, because holy cow, I'm like, how awful is that? You know, that they just, you know, they're that lazy, they don't want to get a good, you know, actually go work for a living. I'm sort of thinking, that's got to be working itself anyhow without them realizing it. And then, you know, I was like, and then shame on them for, you know, taking the hardships of others and finding a way to profit on it. I was just like, oh, it just made me sick. So my other question to you would be is, how would somebody, you know, because I think the biggest problem that I'm seeing, I mean, obviously, someone who's been in the culture of being a homeless person for many years, or even, you know, months, usually it shows to some degree, not always, but usually, you know, I mean, people go, oh, yeah, you know, they're walking around, you can tell they've got the trash bags, or they've got the shopping cart, they've got the dirty clothes. But there are people, especially families that are homeless. They've lost, you know, dad lost his job. Mom was a stay-at-home mom, so she didn't have a job. Now their house has been foreclosed on. So they've sold all their belongings except for, like, you know, their clothing pretty much and the car that they're sleeping in at night. And the kids are still going to school. And, you know, so they look like everything's fine except that it's not. And they're not saying anything to anybody, you know, because pride obviously plays a part in that. And I've seen that happen. And I've lived in low-income housing. I've seen people who are just so prideful that they don't want people to know how much, you know, they are suffering. And so what are some things that might be that you've learned or have picked up on, you know, being around people who've been homeless or families that have been in need that the average person can maybe be on the hunt for? Because I can tell you, where I live out here in southern Utah, in my little town, I know a lot of people have lost their jobs because I live in an area where most of the people in my little town were all construction people, which we all know housing right now is pretty much at a standstill, and so there's not a lot of new homes being built. So a lot of them are, you know, obviously their churches are helping them out. Some of them, being that I live in Utah, a lot of them, you know, they have the food storage, so they're living off their food storage. But, you know, I'm just wondering, you know, I kind of have an idea of what to look for just because, like I said, you know, I've been there myself as a kid. But a lot of people don't know what to look for to identify, you know, maybe this family is in need. You know, what can I do to help this family? I mean, a prime example, at least for me, is my son has a friend. I'm bringing up my son. Good thing he's not around today. But But he has a friend. I don't want to say his friend is either, because I don't want his friend to shoot me later. Not literally shoot me, but, you know, get mad at me and shoot his mouth off at me is what I mean when I say that. I'll clarify that. Anyhow, he would drop by our house in the morning before school, and my son would be eating, you know, and I was like, hey, you know, so-and-so, would you like some to eat? Oh, no, I just ate something. Well, one day he told me he ate a day-old half of a Pop-Tart or something. And I don't think he meant to elaborate as much as he did. And my ears picked up on it. And I went, what? I mean, I didn't say that, but, you know, my mind's going, what? And so I turn around and I'm like, hey, you know, you're welcome, you know, over here anytime you want. You know, when you're over here in the afternoon, you can always stay for dinner. I did in a very way, in a way that wouldn't make him, like, realize that I was going, warning, kid in trouble. But, you know, I just always noticed that he was always very standoffish, you know, anytime I'd offer him stuff. I was like, and I think it was, and obviously I found out later, obviously, you know, his family was having hardship, and so he was lucky he had a meal a day. And, you know, but I kind of knew that warning sign because I had seen it, you know, I've been there. And, of course, you know, he didn't want to take because, you know, he's, of course, the whole pride, and I don't want them to know my family's in trouble. And eventually, you know, he opened up and I found, you know, I was able to get it out of him. But, you know, some people just don't know what to look for, and they don't realize that, you know, maybe their friend, you know, their children's friends are hanging out their house as much as they are because there's something going on at home, you know, be it abuse, be it, you know, mom and dad only have enough food to where, you know, they go hungry, you know, maybe 4 nights a week and only 1 night a week they actually get a dinner. You know, so I'm just kind of curious, you know, what should we be looking for to maybe get an idea there could be a problem? And then on top of that, this is such a loaded question, you know, what type of questions do you think would be probably good probing questions we can ask so we don't put somebody too much on the defense and have them going, oh no, they're finding out, you know, and instead we can get them to open up so we can help, because it's just so sad. I mean, I look at my little two-year-old and I'm just like, I know the two-year-old's going to bed at night that, you know, their parents are thinking, do we heat the house or do we feed our kids? And it's just, it's sad. Well, of course, right now it's, do we cool our house down or die of heat or feed our kids? So, you know, I'm just kind of wondering, because I think sometimes that's the thing. We're not sure what to look for.
I don't think you should look for anything. The way I would look, I would think about this is not to be looking to try to treat somebody different. Treat everybody the same way. Treat them like they have money, or if they have money or they don't have money, invite them into your house for supper. I feel like if you're wanting to help the homeless, you should maybe go to organizations that you know do that and volunteer through them, and that would be a better way to do it. But to actually go out and try to probe people to find out if they're homeless or not, I don't think that's a good thing. I guess I would suggest not doing it. We should all be generous with one another regardless of their circumstances. And if we invite somebody to supper and they end up being homeless and we don't know about it, or they're having low income and we don't know about it, then it's going to be more meaningful to them, but it's not really going to be any different. I think, to me, the more important way to treat homeless people is to treat them as being no different from anyone else. So to me, there's a danger in trying to figure out who is homeless and who's not, because then you tend to see them as being other, as being different than yourself, and they're not. They're just people. So if you're nice to your neighbor who you know has 2 incomes coming in, and you're nice to somebody who you think might be living out of their car, I don't see that you should be any different to either one of those people. So maybe that's not the answer what you were looking for. and maybe kind of leaves us at a dead end in the conversation. So I apologize for that. But to me, the most important thing is treating a homeless person just like a person rather than a homeless person.
No, and I agree. I totally agree. I guess I'm just I think sometimes that there's people who need help and they're afraid to ask for the help too, and sometimes it's hard to know if you have.
Well, that's where it comes in. Like if you're treating them just like everybody else, and you're open and you're friendly just like you are to everybody else, if they need help, they're going to start to trust you. They're going to see you as a person who sees them as another human being, and they won't be ashamed to come and ask you if they need help. Do you see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If they can come to you, all you have to do is have your heart open. If they can see that your heart is open to them and to others, then they're going to feel comfortable coming to you if they need something. That's the way I would do it.
Yeah, that makes sense. And unfortunately, it seems like our society isn't that open anymore. which is probably why we don't see enough people asking for the help they need. I mean, I think you just hit a huge nail on the head right there with that statement. I mean, it's sad as that is to say. I mean, we've gotten so selfish, you know, as a race here. I'm not just saying in the U.S., I'm saying globally that, that I think sometimes that we've gotten selfish as the human race, and we just me most of the time.
Sorry about that. Go ahead, Deb.
we do tend to get narcissistic about our lives, and we have our own opinions, and it's getting more and more difficult to find people who are able to, even if they don't agree with other people, who are able to accept them and still maybe even find things about them that they like. And it's not just with regard to homelessness. You're right. It's regard to everybody.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I find like in the school that I volunteer at several schools actually here in the area where I live in Stratford, and there are a lot of kids that actually come in to school and they seem to be hungry because they haven't had breakfast, and a lot of them choose not to have breakfast, and so we have a whole program here where I guess two or three days a week we give free breakfast to the students, especially at the elementary school level. And that helps, of course, with a lot of, with a lot of kids that don't have breakfast. But how do you tell the difference between, the child that doesn't have breakfast, because he or she chooses not to or didn't have time to have breakfast, as opposed to the, the child that didn't have breakfast because there is no breakfast at home?
Right.
Like we really have no way as educators and as people in schools, to really tell what the difference is. So, we sometimes just try to, be very kind to the kids, and a lot of times the kids open up, and a lot of times they don't, and so it's kind of up to the child, and yet that's such an adult thing to do, isn't it? Like, even a lot of adults don't want to open up about, not having enough food, in the house,
right,
or, having, parents that can't afford food in the house. So I think it's a real problem, isn't it? And it puts a lot on, a lot on the kids' shoulders as to, what they can say and won't say. And a lot of times the parents will say, well, don't say anything, we don't have enough food in the house, but, don't say very much, or don't tell anybody anything or something like that, So it's kind of a very difficult situation, isn't it?
Yeah, and sometimes it does become obvious. Sometimes it does really take a big detective to figure out that that even if they don't tell you that they're homeless and that there's a special need there. And there's certainly nothing, I think, wrong with going out of your way to help someone when you're pretty sure that they're in that kind of situation.
Right.
I think we just have to sort of play it by ear and by heart.
Yeah, and then, of course, if you notice the same student, in addition to that, not having lunch or doesn't have, didn't bring lunch or something like that, then you definitely know that there is a problem, there is something going on. And then the person, the poor little kid has no money either. So then, you know that there's something to look, you have to sort of do a little bit of, be open to at least helping them up and, talking to them and, offering them popcorn or whatever it is, and just sit down and have a chat with them, And I find that kids really open up then, and they really do, just say, we're having problems and this and that, and then you can actually help at that grassroots level,
And the longer people are homeless, the harder it is to keep it hidden, because it's not that easy to find places for showers, and it's not that easy to get your clothes washed on a regular basis. Right. And if you're homeless long enough, no matter how much you're trying to make appearances seem like everything is fine, eventually it is going to be obvious to people, and there's really nothing you can do about it if no help is given.
Right, right.
Well, Deb, I'd like for you, you know, I know that our show was mostly about, you know, just the homeless, you know, communities that are out there and this and that, but I'd love for you to kind of share a little bit about your book and some of the topics that you kind of cover, you know, about that they get covered about the homeless community within your book, Painted Black, because, you know, I've read the reviews, and I know a lot of people really enjoy your book, and even though it's a fictional book, you know, you do touch on the topic, so I'd love for you to kind of just share a little bit about the book and what you kind of have in there. Where, I mean, obviously, you don't want to give your book away. You don't want to give us the whole
no, no.
It, but you know, just
no. But I do like to point out the things that are related to homelessness in both Painted Black, which is out, and then the next book in the series, which is Bend Me, Shape Me, which I'm writing now and hopefully will get out in the middle of next year, because one thing that you'll find when you read the book is it will address the issues if you're noticing it. For instance, the one young girl, Lexi, in Painted Black is homeless because of the fact that she was kicked out by her mother. She was being abused, but her mother kicked her out because she was jealous of her. And a lot of kids are kicked out by their parents, as we've talked about. The other character, Chris, actually leaves voluntarily, mainly because his mother is having a hard time feeding the kids in her family. She's a single parent. And so he actually feels he was trying to do a service to his mother. But at the heart of it, he is hurt that she let him go, and he calls her once in a while to talk to her, and he really wants her to ask him to come back, but she never does. And so I'm trying to make the kids on the street real to the reader. And the main character, Jo Sullivan, she actually relates to these kids and is there to help them, because, quite frankly, people don't really pay that much attention to the kids on the street and maybe don't necessarily believe their story. So, for instance, in Painted Black, when Lexi disappears, if Lexi would have been a kid that was raised in suburban household and her parents said she'd been missing for 24 hours, the police would probably have a pretty high priority to find them. But they don't necessarily think that way about homeless kids, because they don't necessarily believe that anything has happened to them. The kid's just hiding, or the kid has moved on to somewhere else. So the police aren't that worried about it. So that's why Jo gets involved, because she knows that there isn't anybody else to care for them. The same thing with my novel, Bend Me, Shape Me, that I'm working on. The character in that is a bipolar young girl named Snow. And because of her mental illness, people are thinking she's crazy when she starts talking about this psychiatrist that she thinks is trying to hurt her brother. And Jo is the only voice of reason that bothers to listen to these kids. And I'm kind of hoping that the stories of my main characters, but also the little subordinate characters that I have in there, I've sprinkled in little pieces of actual scenes that I came across when I was doing volunteer work that give a sense of reality to what it's like to live on the street there. And so while you're trying to figure out what's happening at this funeral home in Painted Black, you are actually finding out that Jo is her only hope to find out where she is and how she's doing.
Yeah,
that didn't come up quite right, but
yeah, no, I understand what you're saying. And I think you've done a great job with your characters and really painting, you know, a real reality. I mean, even though they're not real people, the fact that there are real people who are very close to these characters in real life that are experiencing or have been in these, you know, in very similar situations. Because, you know, I think that sometimes when people watch TV, you know, watch a movie or read a book, they think, oh, you know, that writer or writers, you know, had a crazy, wild imagination. But, I mean, which you know, because, you know, being around homeless people and helping within those communities, I mean, these are very real, you know, scenarios and truths. I mean, I always tell people that the difference between, actually, it's not my saying, it's actually a saying from Tom Clancy, but it's, I actually have it on my on my desktop every day because I look at it because it's so true. But what Tom Clancy said was the difference between fiction and reality, fiction has to make sense. And it is such a true statement because the reality is a lot of times these awful things happen to people and there's no rhyme or reason to it. And sometimes it just sounds so crazy and just out there that you're like, this can't be real. But it is. You know, I think it, you know, and that's the thing. So I think it's great that you've really, you know, thought about these characters and really pulled from, you know, what you've seen and
real life,
you know, and have heard to, yeah, to really, because, I mean, they're really fleshed out, you know, true characters, which is great because you're right. I mean, you talked about your one character was kicked out, you know, by her, you know, parents. I mean, it happens. I see it here in Southern Utah all the time.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
I mean, And I can say this because my husband's not home right now, but you're talking about the officers and how the police department, hopefully none of them are listening to my show ever today because they're going to be like, your wife. But, and I'm not bashing, because I know, obviously I know a lot of officers, you know, police and sheriff department that are wonderful men. But unfortunately the reality is if the parents don't make a big deal about it, you know, and they don't seem like, oh, you know, and they make it kind of, I'm serious, and they make it like, oh, yeah, well, you know, they've ran off before, they will look at it as runaway versus, you know, kidnapping, whatever, and they won't look at other problems at home. Is that why they ran away? I mean, they'll just think the kid ran away, and it'll be left at that. And there's actually a scenario that happened like that in my area where the parents, you know, we're just kind of like, well, she's been having trouble, this, that, or whatever. And, you know, she was out on the street for some time, and, you know, eventually she was found. But as the story started, being unwrapped, we found out that it was actually not just that she was a problem child, and the parents were just like, oh, she's just a problem child. It was way deeper than that, the situation, which is why she did run away from home. But, you know, you're right. I mean, if it was suburbia and the mom and dad were like, oh, my gosh, my kid, and I just turned around for a second, all of a sudden it's like Amber Alert, kidnapping, everybody's looking for the kid.
Mm-hmm.
So,
right.
And that's the thing, you know, it's true. I mean, a lot of the kids on the street, they're on the street because their mom or dad or guardian, whoever it is, didn't bother to even call and even say they were gone. They're like, oh, good, they're gone. Yeah, and usually it's because the parents, unfortunately, are, well, they shouldn't have been parents, or the guardian shouldn't have been a guardian. It's pretty much what goes through my head, because either they're being abusive to the kid, or they're neglecting the kid, which is still abuse in my mind. So.
Right, right.
You know, and then these poor kids, and that's why they don't trust adults, and why it's, I think, hard for them to open up, like Irene said, because they're thinking, why should I trust you, the people who are supposed to be taking care of me, I couldn't even trust, and
right.
You're a complete stranger, and it's just, it's sad.
Yeah,
it is a sad thing.
Yeah, and it's different if it's an adult that's out there. You shouldn't even assume that an adult is out there simply because there's something completely wrong with them. But when it's a kid, you would think that people would be more inclined to give them the benefit of a doubt and think that maybe there was something wrong and that's why they're there. But no, for the most part, people look at kids on the street and they blame them rather than try to find out what's really behind their story.
Yeah, it's true. Well, and, you know, they blame adults too. And I'm not saying every doll on the street, obviously, because some of them are out there, you know. I know, especially in California, there at one time, a lot of I don't know what the number is anymore because it was so many years ago, decades ago, made you myself again. But they had done a statistic on the homeless that were out on the streets in the Los Angeles area or Southern California area, and the majority of them were homeless because the mental institutions had either been closed down and they had no other place to put them, so they were just turned out. And they had nowhere to go, so they ended up on the streets, or they were just, mentally, had mental disabilities, and nobody knew, and they just kind of wandered off one day, and nobody could find them, and ended up out on the streets. And, not saying that everybody's, and when I say mental patient, I'm not saying they're going to be complete schizophrenic, got to be careful, crazy person. I mean, some of these people,
somebody who's depressed, for instance, yeah.
Yeah, it could be someone depressed. It could be somebody who has amnesia for all you know. I mean, simple, it can be, not dementia. I mean, oh, my gosh, my husband and I came across somebody out here in Southern Utah who was on the street, and he looked really confused. And my husband kind of walked up and said, sir, can I help you? Are you looking, are you trying to find your direction somewhere? And we ended up figuring out this guy had dementia and had been on the streets for months.
Oh,
like, oh, my God.
Wow.
It happens. I mean, he was an older gentleman, and, he was a little dirty, so we knew something wasn't right. And luckily, my husband went over there and kind of started talking to him, and that's what we found out. My husband's like, yeah, he must have dementia, and we ended up calling, one of the officers to come get the poor guy and hopefully help maybe find his family or at least put him somewhere so he wasn't on the street. But, yeah.
Wow.
I mean, like I said, you never know, and so we can't just assume that, that people want to be on the street because they want to be on the street. And I know that's another stigma that's out there. Oh, well, if they didn't want to be on the street, they wouldn't be.
Yeah, if they would work hard enough, they would have some place to live. That's what they think.
Yeah, and I can tell you, I have a bunch of empty houses around in my area right now, in my neighborhood, and the families, when they left them, I know some of them had places to go, some of them supposedly were moving in with other family, but their houses were foreclosed on because they didn't have jobs, and I know it's not because, they wanted to lose their house, it just happened.
Couldn't find a job, yeah, and stuff,
yeah.
But there's a lot of that going around.
So how can people that want to get involved and help homeless communities, be it, if they work in a soup kitchen, in a shelter, some type of crisis center, I mean, there's all different kinds of names. I mean, what would be a good way for people to research and find out how they can get involved in their communities and play an active role and hopefully at least lessen what seems to be a growing problem right now? Not saying it hasn't always been a problem. It just seems like it's bigger right now just with everything happening. That,
right.
That so they can get involved. So, I mean, I know there's a lot of people who want to do good. My husband's mom, she sews pillowcases and makes blankets that get given out through different various charities to people, on the streets or who are struggling or whatever. My kids and I, every year we put together – around back-to-school time, we put together the back-to-school kits for, families that are hurting. When we have no idea if it's just because if they're low-income families or if it's just because they actually are on the street type families, we have no idea, but we do the care packages. We even do the personal, cares like shampoo and soap and deodorant and toothbrushes and toothpaste. We do those too. So it's like every 6 months we do one, and then 6 months later we do the other kind. And we do that through our church organization. So I'm just kind of curious. I mean, people who don't have churches that offer those kinds of things, or how can they find this information so they can do something and be involved?
I guess it depends on how big of a city you're living in or what kind of area you're living in. But I would just say start with the internet for one thing. You could just do a little Google search for volunteer opportunities homeless. And if there's some organizations that have an internet presence, they would pop up. But if that doesn't work, or if you're in a more rural area that might have some organizations that aren't really all that put together, that they would have an actual website, going to maybe the different churches or the different police stations and ask about opportunities. That's the only thing I can think of. The other thing is you don't necessarily need to have an organization to do it. You could start something of your own. I know someone that's an architect here in Seattle, and his office happens to be down along the canal where a lot of the homeless people hang out. And he actually started out simply by talking to the guys that he would walk by as he was going to his office every day. And he ended up inviting them in once in a while, to, which is like a cup of coffee and something like that, and started a Facebook page for them. And he takes pictures and posts little stories about them every once in a while on his Facebook page and has gotten other people involved in it. If you see someone that's got a sign on the corner or is asking for change, stop and talk to them. Eventually, if you talk to them often enough, you might find out a little bit more about them. They might know of an organization. Maybe you could say, you know, is there any, do you know where you're sleeping tonight? And they could say, oh, yes, I'm staying at this shelter over on such and such street. And that would be another opportunity for you to figure out what organizations there are around you that might be helping. I know even in the small town that I grew up in, that my mom is still living in Illinois, there's an organization that has different churches that take turns making food. So my mom is, I think, once a month or once every 2 weeks going with her little church group and cooking lasagna and serving lasagna to about, I think, 15 people. But 15 homeless people in a town of 10,000 is a lot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That is a lot.
Yeah.
Wow. Well, thanks, Deb. I mean, it's been great having you on the show, talking a little bit about your book, talking about, you know, just kind of to remember that everybody's a person. You know, it's sad that we get tainted and let our perceptions kind of take over, you know, when we look at people, be it skin color, the way they're dressed, you know, where they're sleeping. It's a sad thing, and we need to take our blinders off and realize that you're right. Everybody has feelings, and we just need to be there and help when we can, because it's sad to think that, you know, people get pushed down and everybody just is like, oh, can't go over there and go pick them up because I might get beat up next, or oh my gosh, they're homeless. If I give them money, you know, they might try and mug me, you know, further down the street because they know now I have money in my purse. And it's like, oh my gosh, come on, people. I'm not saying that stuff like that doesn't happen, but it's so rare to. The positives. I mean, and I can
exactly.
say I worked in downtown LA. Trust me, you know, if people are getting mugged all the time, it would be covered with cops, and it isn't. And I didn't see people getting mugged left and right, and I definitely did not hear about it on the news all the time that people are getting mugged. So, you know, most of the time, you're right. People they're just hoping that they have a meal or a place to sleep at the end of the day, and they don't think beyond that too much.
Right.
So. Well,
I'm
going
to look forward to reading your book, so
yeah.
Sorry.
Thank you.
Is there anything else you'd like to let our listeners know, where they can learn more about you, where they can find your book, Painted Black? Anything upcoming you have going on?
Sure. You can go to either Amazon.com or Barnes & Noble or the iBookstore if you wanted to order it online. But quite frankly, you could walk into any bookstore and just ask them to order you a copy of Painted Black, and you can get it that way. If you want more information about me, I've got a couple of websites they could go to. One is simply www.paintedblacknovel.com, where I have information about the book. But my personal author novel is www.deborah-r-boris.com. So they can look me up there. I try to get some interesting blogs out there about homelessness, but about writing and about my take on life in general. So it's not all related just to the book. I try to, anything that strikes my interest, I'll slap up there and hopefully get some feedback from people to see what they think too.
Could
yeah,
you repeat that website for everyone again, Deb?
It would be www.deborah-r-boris, which is BORYS.com.
Okay, thank
that's
you.
That's probably the best one to go to. You can get to the other site through there if you want to, but that's the one that's the most active.
Yeah, and then and so our listeners know too, on our Family Matters blog, which is familiesmattertous.blogspot.com, on April 12th, Deb did a guest post about her book and a little bit about her characters and homelessness on there as well, so you can check out that really great post. We also, I think, have a link to it in our show description as well, so you can click on that link and read it, and all her links are there too, so definitely go check it out, and we thank everybody for listening, and again, Deb, it was a pleasure having you on the show and talking about this. I'm looking forward to your second book. I think it's, you know, it's awesome that, you know, that you're right. I mean, you're a great writer anyways, but you're also addressing issues and building characters that are, you know, main characters that are doing stuff and showing that, you know, people can come from all kinds of diverse backgrounds and they still matter and can do amazing things in their lives and stuff
exactly.
too. So
yeah.
Thanks so much. And we wish everybody
right,
a great
thanks
welcome.
So much, Deborah.
And we wish everybody a great week because it is Wednesday, so we're almost to the end of the week. And we have, for those who are in the U.S., the 4th of July coming up, Nick, a week from, I think it's a week from today. I think it's on a Wednesday.
Yes, it is.
Next
I think
week.
So,
yes,
yeah.
I know. My gosh. Crazy.
Art's coming up, too. So
yeah,
it's Monday,
so. And the Canadian Independence Day is coming up as well. So for everybody in Canada, we hope you guys have a safe Independence Day as well. And I know I talked to Marcia Casper Cook today. She is planning, I think, a show Tuesday next week, and then I think this Saturday, could be wrong. I know our at Storytime Gather Round with J.D. Holliday and Christy, and I forget her last name. I always forget her last name. Anyways, they have their show on Saturday, and they're booked out all the way to August, so tune in on Saturdays to our network. It's a great time to listen to stories being read or an excerpt of a book being read, of a YA book or a children's book by the author, and sometimes the hosts read them if the authors can't make it, but it's a great way to get a nice glimpse of stories and to get together with your kids and enjoy a little bit of a story time without leaving your home. And then, like I said, we will have a Family Matters show in July. So on the fourth Wednesday of July, we will be talking with Irene Roth. We're going to turn the tables on her. She gets to be our guest and talk about her book. Can you talk about what the subject is, Irene, so our listeners know? I think we just lost Irene. Oh, we lost Irene. Okay, hers is very, it's tied to what we talked about last month, which was the 7 habits of highly effective teens. Hers is going to be, I think it's close to that, but it's geared more toward elementary and middle grade kids. So it will be a fun topic. She's going to be writing a whole series on how to have confident children. And so it's going to be a fun book series. And her first book will be coming out around that time. So we're going to have her then. And we have a couple of Stories for Children shows on Monday of next month as well with some great authors. So if you want to learn about some authors that are doing virtual tours, you need to tune in on Monday. And that's what we have lined up for the upcoming month. Kind of going to be a busy month, even though it's summer. So we thank you all for listening, and have a great rest of the evening. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Me to the world of Inc.